If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
To understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. I think we're now on the seventh night. And unfortunately, the distributist has had to reschedule unavoidable. I'll see what I can do about that. But there are four streams nonetheless. In 2 hours, it'll be, 3 hours, it'll be Mark Houghton and then Jared Taylor and then the Midway AMA. But in the meantime, I have a much requested and anticipated guest each year, and that is Godfrey Bloom. Godfrey, thank you for appearing again. I think you've appeared four times before now. So thank you very much. Would you like to just give people a brief introduction to yourself in case anyone doesn't know?
Bit of a mixed bag. A soldier with a remarkably undistinguished record, I have to say. I was a fund manager in the City of London with a rather more successful background. And I spent, how long was it? 10 years as an MEP, finishing as an independent MEP in Strasbourg and Brussels. So I've seen the inside the belly of the beast, as it were. I'm also a published military historian and Austrian school economist. So it's a bit of a mixed bag in a days of high specialization these days, I'm afraid, where everybody has to do just one thing. I'm very happy. And the only decent thing about being an old man is that I've had an opportunity to do lots of stuff.
Yeah. I think that's been the way for the last 10 or 20 years, where people are quite narrowly focused, and there seems to be an aversion to trying different things throughout your life. And I think it's nice to meet someone who's had a more varied career. So let's get to and I should say that this is going to be quite a short stream. We've got about 45 minutes. So if you want to ask Godfrey a question, now would be the time to post the super chat. Do it as soon as you can. So let's go through, just talk about 2025 as a year, geopolitics, events. What would you say have been the standout occurrences this year?
I think the totally continued abandonment of our protections, our institutional protections under our Magna Carta Constitution, principles of English law, so on and so forth. They've all been abandoned. I've got to be frank, they've been abandoned gradually for some time, for the last few decades. But I was brought up in the 50s as a lad and the 60s and the early 60s at school. A keen historian. I'm still a keen historian. I'm still published on military history and so on and so forth. And I still don't do so much lecturing on military history as I used to. But I'm still in that field, and I see that we have abandoned all these protections. And I suppose it comes as no surprise when we saw Keir Starmer being interviewed before he was elected by Emily Nomates. And she actually asked him that famous question, did she not? Is Davos more important than Parliament? And he said, yes, of course it is. You know, all the real decisions are made in Davos. Parliament's just a talking shop. This is the most extraordinary thing I think anybody could have ever heard in modern British history. He's obviously, one would imagine, a supporter of King Charles I. And so he doesn't believe in Parliament. He doesn't obviously believe in the principles of English law. He doesn't believe in Magna Carta or the principles of Magna Carta, which, of course, actually was a sort of a roundup, if you want to be oversimplistic, of Anglo-Saxon law before that. So he's consigned over 1,000 years of British history or English history to the dustbin, doesn't seem to care. And like so many others in the Conservative Party before him, the previous government, he's clearly a sociopath. And I did an interview with Professor Dutton on this very subject, and he explained to me why he is a sociopath and how he became a sociopath, how it wasn't necessarily his fault. It was a very difficult upbringing because of a very sick mother. And consequently, when we get that very vacant stare that we get, and that almost fascinating void where most of us would put some kind of personality with Keir Starmer, and indeed some of his henchmen, he doesn't seem to understand when he's wrong. He doesn't seem to have any concept of what is true and what is false. And he obviously doesn't have any form of conscience, which is, of course, the great mark of the sociopath.
I actually surmised the same thing, that his upbringing deprived him of an opportunity for his character to develop, because he was always looking after his mother. I just wondered. I mean, obviously, there's a limit, especially as laymen like me, to how much we can surmise about someone's background and their psychology. But it just occurred to me as a possibility. Either way, we do have a very strange man as Prime Minister. And as you say, the vacant stare, the apparent obsession with rules to the, like, in the letter rather than the spirit, is very strange. And his apparent complete disinterest in whether he's liked or not by the public, because obviously most politicians are the opposite. They really want to be adored and they want the adulation. But with him, it seems to be a complete afterthought as to whether the public actually like or trust him. It's just, is he doing his job or not? Very strange guy. About Parliament, that again is, as you say, very interesting, because it's a talking shop. The very word, the very name Parliament comes from the French to speak. In a way, you could say that's baked in. But the idea that it doesn't achieve anything or establish anything is amazing. And it shows how the seat of government has changed over the last 100 years from national governments to international bodies, the globalist bodies.
Yes, and the interesting part is that nobody makes any excuses or tried to hide it. I think if you went back long enough, there was always this globalist outlook, but people would try and keep it dark. Excuse me. In a representative democracy, to actually go before election and say, I know we have a representative democracy, but I don't care. And of course, yes, Parliament is a talking shop, but it's also a lawmaking body. So you talk first and then you vote on the law and then you have your amending chamber in the House of Lords, which, of course, needless to say, they've stuffed with Labour supporters, because you would never, even with the modern House of Lords, who's virtually rudderless, would ever pass the concept of the abandonment of trial by jury or the principles of English law. No House of Lords, regardless of their background, whether they were real lords or temporary lords or anything, would have done that. And this is the sort of problem that we have, that nobody ever picks up on them. We have on legacy media very highly paid journalists, political journalists, who never seem to pick up on these matters. And of course, we had the same. It was interesting when I interviewed Professor Dutton, who's an expert in these fields. It was quite interesting. He said, of course, Boris Johnson had the same kind of rather bizarre upbringing. He changed his name when he went to Oxford. He wasn't called Boris at school. He changed his name and adopted, or if you were nurtured, some sort of personality which isn't his own. You know, the easy go, easy come, easy go, blonde, semi-buffoon kind of rather lovable nature that he performed. And that isn't him at all. And I'll give you an example and your viewers on this particular idea. Let's take it this way. There was a peace agreement signed in April 2022 in Turkey, which had signatures on it for a secession, a peace deal, if you will, between the Ukraine and the Russian Federation. That was, you know, way back then, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So what an interesting situation that we had this agreement, and who would fly out to actually stop it, physically stop it by flying to Kiev? And it was Boris Johnson. And since that time, difficult to get exact figures, but one might argue that there's been at least 1 million young men killed or maimed since that date. And we suspect rather more. Mainly on the Ukrainian side, incidentally, if you believe what is actually more factual than legacy media or legacy newspapers. Now, if I or you or any of your viewers, or certainly most of your viewers, had sabotaged a peace agreement with everybody's signature on it, which was in hindsight, a very generous agreement. It was a very generous agreement by the Russian Federation. Who didn't really want territory. They just wanted to stop the murder of ethnic Russians within the Ukraine, which was growing at a significant number, which is largely undisputed, 14 or 15,000. And these are the sort of problems that we had. Now, had you or I sabotaged that peace agreement, we would have very significant trouble with our conscience. He sleeps tight. It washes over him. He's not interested. He doesn't care. Now, if you had a million deaths on your conscience, you would be very seriously demotivated to be in politics at all. Indeed, you'd probably grow a beard and go to Canada and shoot grizzly bears or something, but you'd disappear or go into a nunnery or whatever it happens to be. He doesn't care. He doesn't care. What we're dealing with this man, Boris Johnson, is that he is mentally unwell, which is what being a preclinical sociopath is. And that's generally speaking how experts in this field, which I don't claim to be, seem to see it that way. And I think they're right.
There was also a clip of Boris Johnson put out a clip of himself. I think it was at the start of last year. The establishment seems to be gearing up for actual war with Russia. Of some kind. And at that time, I think it was in January, February last year, and he posted this clip of himself.
So, Lance Corporal Johnson reporting for duty and responding to the appeal from General Sanders for a citizen army and encouraging young people across the country to think of the attractions, advantages of some kind of military training or service, because at the moment they think it's either uncool or unethical, or perhaps they're not following General Sanders, they're following Colonel Sanders.
So that's him encouraging people to sign up for a military career in order to defend the country. And that was at the time when, I mean, there was no doubt that that was connected to the warnings that war with Russia was on the cards. You had a military career yourself, so I'm not decrying that at all. I'm condemning him for taking part in the ginning up of a war that just absolutely doesn't seem to be necessary, but will lead to many young British men getting killed for reasons that are baffling to all of us.
It is. It's rather typical of politicians with no military service or no great knowledge of military history, which I include Boris Johnson. So you have a situation here where there's no real understanding of war. And if you really want to understand war, I mean, I've devoted a lot of study to war and warfare. And I'm also an associate member of the Royal College of Defence Studies in Strategy. And I've given papers at military colleges all over the world, America included. And the problem is that most people don't have an understanding of what real war is. And of course, that generation is dying out. My father was a fighter pilot in the war, and he was quite badly injured in the North African campaign. Flew a Spitfire, was badly burnt, and he was under McKindu, the great surgeon at East Grinstead, where they're still trying to put soldiers and sailors and airmen back together again after horrific injuries in more recent wars. So there is no real knowledge. There's nobody these days. It's a very distant past. Grandfather, maybe. Father, unusually so. You have to be my age, and I'm nearer 80 than 70. So nobody really understands what warfare is. And the last thing you would want is a war. The last thing you would also want is a war with a major land power, one of the most powerful now in the world. So they have 1.5 million men under arms, and they have integrated warfare systems. They have drones, air. It's a very integrated system now. It was always integrated, even going back to 1944 with the air support of armored warfare in 1944, 1945 in Normandy and North Africa, so on and so forth. So this isn't a new phenomenon, but it's now at a degree of such high sophistication that in order to put even a modest opposition to the Russian Federation would be absolutely impossible. Not the fact that we can only put probably one, let's say one or two at most, armored supported divisions in the field. And the Russian Federation count them in hundreds. In hundreds. I mean, not even close. We're not even close. And the warfare, the integration is that they now have 3 years' experience. And any soldier, any ex-soldier watching this will tell you that there is no substitute for combat experience. You have to have combat experience any more than you can actually become a good rugby player, an international rugby player, if you'd only trained in the gym. If you only done gymnasium work and so on and so forth, and you suddenly went into to play in the Calcutta Cup, if your side had only been in the gym, they'd get a good pasting. Combat experience, and of course the Americans found that up at Kesselring Pass in North Africa, Operation Torch, I think in 1943, when they landed and they bumped into the Africa Corps and got absolutely murdered because the Africa Corps knew exactly what they're doing and had been fighting for years together in the northern desert. And the Americans just weren't used to that, so they got duffed up. Same with boxing. I used to do a little bit of boxing. You have to actually box. You can work out on the bag as much as you like. Very nice too, because the bag doesn't hit your back. But it's not going to get you very far in the ring. So Boris Johnson simply doesn't understand. And now here's the worst thing. Here's the worst thing. Not only that, our senior generals don't understand. We've only done in aid of the civil power, which in my day we used to call it in aid of the civil power. So that would be Northern Ireland and things like that. Oh, we've fought second-rate powers. That we did in Iraq, notwithstanding that they were not brave fellows, I'm not decrying them anyway, but they weren't a first-rate power. And of course, then we were in Afghanistan, and we actually were beaten out of Afghanistan with guys with homemade rifles. That's a long and short of it. That's a long and short of it. With all the tanks and helicopters and so on that we had, we didn't win that campaign. So suggest that we could even begin to go up against the Russians. So people say, well, what about NATO? We've got allies. Ha! The French? I don't think so. The Belgians? The Danes? No. No good at all. Dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Hopeless. And I got a feeling that our army now isn't what it was. I know all old soldiers say that. But the army used to be, up until relatively recently, a meritocracy. You know, if you were the best lad in the squad, eventually you'd get a stripe or two stripes. And if you were very good indeed, you'd get into the sergeant's mess. And if you had the right educational background and prepared to go over the top with a swagger stick and a tooting horn and die, that's all right. You got to be an officer. That's good. But that's how it was. Now it's all wokery. It's not for soldiers. It doesn't make soldiers. So, which is why recruitment is so low. The British Army isn't recruiting. It's not recruiting. And they're losing officers in the Royal Air Force, so on and so forth. And the ships are all broken down in the Royal Navy. They're all in port being put back together again. So the idea that we could even begin to think about going war is impossible and ludicrous. So what would be good, would it not? Why don't we reinvent diplomacy? Why don't we talk to people? Wouldn't it be better to talk to the Russian Federation? The Russian Federation don't want to invade anybody else. All they want to do is secure their 1,000-mile border with the Ukraine. They want to, that's what they want. We're talking about a security guarantee at the moment, but don't we want the Russian Federation wants a security guarantee? And if you think that's not possible, I can assure everybody it is possible. If you go back to Austria in 1946 after the war, you'll find the Russians sat round a table with the Americans and the British and said, yeah, we don't want Austria to be in NATO. We don't want Austria to be in NATO because it was strategically very awkward for them. And we saw their point in diplomacy. We said, we'll keep Austria out. Austria has no foreign troops. It's not a member of the NATO. And it's been a relatively prosperous country ever since. And that could be quite good. Ukraine has lots of natural advantages. It's agriculturally speaking and so on and so forth. It could have easily been a neutral power, but the Americans didn't want that. And make no mistake, this is all stirred up by the Americans. I am not anti-American. I have lots of American friends. But if you want to see who's the evil and dangerous power now on the face of the globe, have a look at a bloody map and a map which has bases, American bases on it. And you'll see that it is the Russian Federation that is surrounded in a hostile manner with air bases, American air bases and American missiles. And they just added Sweden and Finland. Finland has been living quite happily since about 1942 with the Russians. Now the Americans are pouring stuff in there and all the rest of it. And of course, the Soviet Union, the Russian Federation, see it now as a threat, as indeed the old Soviet Union would have done. Everything is being done, it seems to me, as it was ever thus, by old men sending young men to war for no good reason. And it started, you could argue with the Boer War, but it certainly started big time in 1914. What a disaster that was. What did we get out of the 1914-18 war? And the answer is bugger all. And we're trying to start another one.
Yeah. And there does really seem to be a clamoring for it. I have people who are angry with me for not taking Ukraine's side in all of this. And some of them are my friends, and I feel a bit bad about it. But the way it seems to me is that Ukraine has been played by America and used to gin up war with Russia. That just seems to be obvious, even though there are legitimate, you know, the Ukrainians obviously don't want to be taken over. They don't want to be invaded, et cetera, et cetera. But nonetheless, they've been played. They've been used by the Americans, or at least by the American elite. And now their population is their young male population, I believe, is decimated, and they're going to need, or they're saying they're going to need, mass immigration from Africa to replace the lost young men. I mean, it's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. And everyone predicted this 3 years ago, that this is what it would, nearly 4 years ago now, that this would be the result if they didn't succumb to Russian demands. And I know that people can say, well, that's humiliation, that's national humiliation. But, well, what's the reality? What's actually happened is national humiliation.
I've also lost a couple of good friends. One very, very good friend of long standing who now doesn't talk to me, which I think is very sad. It's a shame you can't disagree about something without actually having to completely cut yourself off at the legs. But that's how it is. My experience of people who actually take that view in the main are people without any great understanding or knowledge of the situation. They probably just read British newspapers. They probably listen to the BBC, legacy media, and all the rest of it. And we have seen the greatest avalanche of propaganda on this war in the Ukraine, I would argue, since 1914, where the Northcliffe Press dominated propaganda from 1914, which is why we went in to a war, which was nothing to do with us. There was no treaty obligation to go into the war in 1914. And I actually met historians, or people who call themselves historians, say, well, we were treaty bound under the Treaty of London to go in to maintain Belgian neutrality. This is simply not true. It always tells me that here's a man who's claiming to be a historian, doesn't know his own business, There was no reason to go in 1914 at all, because the treaty, there was a treaty which Palmerston instigated, and the treaty was tripartite. All right? It was tripartite. As soon as somebody dropped out, and the Germans did by invading Belgium, the treaty became void. And if you look at Hansard, if you look at Hansard in 1914, June 1914, July 1914, you will find almost nobody made the argument that we were treaty bound to go in to the Great War, and it was going to be over by Christmas anyway. So this was a kind of dreadful thing that we found in the next thing. And we lost 3 million, of the British Empire killed or maimed. And it just went on and on and on to no great end. And today, people don't know why we got into it. Nobody today can give you a decent idea why we had anything to do with yet another Franco-Prussian war. We didn't go in 1870. So your friend or friends who take that view do it from a position of ignorance. Now, I know in social interaction, there's no much point in you saying, well, the reason you take that view is because you're just pig ignorant, which is the truth of the matter. Because if you believe the BBC, and people still do, not many now, admittedly, people still do, and you believe your leader in the Daily Telegraph or the Daily Express about the big bad Russians wanting to take over the whole world, if you believe that kind of bullshit, I would argue not a friend worth having, to be frank.
So what if it wasn't the Treaty of London and an obligation to protect Belgium? In June and July, Hansard, what were they saying in terms of the... This is not relevant to... Well, it is kind of relevant to 2025. What actually was going on in terms of... Why were they saying that Britain should go to war in June, July 1914?
The Northcliffe Press were making the same kind of argument the Legacy Press make today. It's very relevant indeed that there's a moral obligation, that there's a moral obligation to go to war on the side of the French, who are our natural enemy, of course, anyway, in order to protect them from the Germans, which Palmerston didn't see and the British government didn't see in 1870. They thought, no, this is a normal punch-up, continental punch-up, and we'll stay well clear, and we should stay well clear. Now, the Ukraine has nothing to do with us at all. You couldn't be more remote. So what's it got to do with us? And why have we got hundreds of soldiers out there and have been out there for some years, which is just coming true. And everybody poo-pooed me and said, oh, I didn't know what I was talking about. Bloody true, I can tell you. And they're being knocked over. So this is one of the problems that we have. Is this implication as a moral obligation, poor little Ukraine being invaded by big bad Russia, the Russian bear? It's not like that. It was a regime change organized by the CIA and MI6, who are trying to organize regime change in the Russian Federation to have access. To have access to its wealth, its rare earth minerals, its gas, its oil, and all the other things that come with the Russian Federation. And this is what the war is all about. It's all about CIA and MI6. And in order to do that, you have to stoke up your ordinary Englishman or your Scotsman or whatever it happens to be, to make him feel that there's some moral obligation. There's a moral obligation to support the Ukraine. Now, there is no such obligation at all, either in treaty or from a social perspective. What is good for Ukraine would have been for the Ukraine to do the Austrian system in 1946, be no foreign troops on the territory, don't be aggressive. And of course, what was happening in that period of 2014 up to when Zelensky came in 2019, it actually got in, he got elected on a campaign of being good relations with the Russian Federation. But of course, none of my friends or your friends who think that way can be bothered to make any reference to that or think about that. And it was actually Ukrainian artillery in the Donbass whose tally of ethnic Russians got over 14,000. In the end, the Russians said, just a minute, we can't go on doing this. We've got to have some kind of settlement. And the settlement, as I said, in April 2022, was a very generous settlement. And it was buggered by the MI6 on CIA, who sent Boris Johnson out there to tear up the treaty. And that's what he did. So I'm afraid when the Russian Federation captured Odessa, and I graduated in global military strategy, If you look at a map, and I bet none of your mates have even bothered to look at a map of the Ukraine, you'll find that the key, strategic key to the whole thing of the Black Sea is Odessa. So when Odessa falls, we talk about Kiev, it's not Kiev, it's Odessa. And when the Russians take Odessa, which incidentally is mainly ethnic Russian and Russian speaking, and Michael Caine would say not a lot of people know that, they will go in, they will do that. And the war will be over because it can't continue if the one major port that the Ukrainians have for imports and exports and military support is Odessa, which it is. So it will end anyway. You can always tell if you know to read the runes with the Americans. They're already making noises to pull out because I was born in 1949. I've seen so many wars that the Americans started and then abandoned. Suddenly, like Vietnam, Afghanistan, everywhere else, they suddenly go. And it doesn't matter, you see, because what people also don't understand with America, the United States, is that the winning the war is not the point. Winning the war really isn't the point. It's the industrial military complex who want to fight the war because that's where the money is. And that's where on the Hill they make, or they've all got their backhanders. If it's not backhanders from the industrial military complex, it's from Israel. They've got all these backhanders. So everybody on the Hill is a bought man. Everybody is a bought man. And wars are very nice if you don't have to go. And notice that clip you played from Boris Johnson. He's too old and fat to be a soldier. So he's going to be yet another silly old sod sending young men to their doom. He needs, if anybody needed a bit of a slapping, it's Boris Johnson.
Yeah, definitely. After everything he's done, I mean, the Boris wave, we don't even need to go into that.
Don't even go there.
But the it seems to, one other theory about this is that the in Europe, the Western European countries, their elites or the EU elites, they want war with Russia as a way to distract and disrupt the economic disaster that we're heading towards in the West. In other words, that a war would solve everything because we're in enormous debt. We're heading for a mother of all recessions. Those aren't my words. I'm just summarizing what other people have said. And so a huge war is just what we need right now. Do you think there's any truth to that theory?
It's always been a card to play. It's a bit like the Queen of Spades or whatever it is. I'm not a card player. You know, it's the lucky card. It's the one kill all thing, hoping that you'll draw people together. And it's been a mistake that has been made for many, many years in modern times. It's a jingoistic view, if you will, of let's have a jolly good war, it'll get us all together, rah, rah, and that's how it's going to pull the thing through. And that was very much how it worked out in 1899 with the Boer War. That's how it worked out, particularly before then, with the Crimean War, of course, is where the term jingoism came from, the song by Jingo, et cetera, et cetera, the music halls. 1939 was different. We went to war in 1939 with an air of quiet resignation because we knew the Nazis were very nasty people indeed, and they certainly probably would come for us eventually. Maybe we don't know that that's true or not now, but it's a war theory. Now, the trouble is, in order to do that, you have to have a disciplined society to bring them in. So nobody now wants to be a soldier. We don't have a disciplined society. It would take a long time to make some of these people soldiers. And I know because I used to have something to do with the recruitment policy and the recruitment training when I was in the army many years ago. People want to be a soldier. People are patriotic. And you've only got to look at the England football supporters or the Welsh rugby supporters or whatever it happens to be. People are fundamentally patriotic. But you won't scare them asking for a war with Russia. Because nobody will understand why we would have a war with Russia. They don't understand it because the enemy is on our doorstep. Now, if you said join the army or join the navy and help us turn the boats back, all right, or round up illegals and send them back, you would find recruitments would shoot up. The recruiting offices would be packed because people would see that as their patriotic duty. But there's no patriotic duty to have a war with Russia. Nobody wants a war with Russia. Who, is there any of your viewers here watching this, and the game is, do you think that your family is likely to be threatened in any way, or your daughters in particular, by Russians or illegal immigrants? Answer that question to yourself. And so, of course, what happens is that people are focusing on the wrong thing. So Boris Johnson and other pathetic individuals can bang the drum as much as they like and say, come on, take the Queen's shilling. Nobody's going to take a blind bit of bloody notice.
Yeah, I think this is a huge problem that they've got, that the public just aren't on board, and they're not going to be on board. They would have to manufacture some sort of pretext, like fake a Russian attack somewhere, and that might get the public on board with going to war with them. But short of that, I just don't see it. I'll ask you about some other events from this year. I'm really glad that you mentioned the trial by jury outrage, because nobody else so far on Millennial has mentioned that. But before we get to that, do you have anything to say about the Afghan asylum scandal earlier this year? I think it was around June, July, where it was revealed that the government has been secretly bringing thousands of Afghan people over here who helped during the, who helped Britain during the war there, supposedly. And their families, they brought their relatives over. I think each one was entitled to bring 20 relatives. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing. Do you have anything to say about that? Because to me, that's one of the big stories of this year.
Well, I think you're right. I was in Afghanistan a few years ago in my capacity as Armed Forces Parliamentary Observer. And I went up to Camp Bastion and various other things. And spent a bit of time there. And I can assure you that the number of people that helped the British the coalition of the willing, call it whatever you like, the Americans and so on, that was Americans and British, really. Yeah. There were other nations there, but they weren't doing any fighting. They're doing a lot of poncing about. But this is the problem that we have. Now, yes, and I met some of them. I met some of the Afghan officers who claimed asylum in the United States after we all fled out the back door. And they were very nice guys, and they deserved asylum. The people that are coming now have nothing to do with that. They weren't translators. They weren't interpreters. Otherwise, they'd be able to speak English, wouldn't they? And they'd offer a skill. They would offer a skill when they came here. And they don't offer any skills because they don't have any skills. And what you've got to understand is Afghanistan is in the Stone Age. You're importing people from the Stone Age. Here, believe me, I tell you, I've met some things. I know these people. I've seen these people. They're very, very bad people. That's not to say every Afghan is bad, or indeed any Pakistani is bad, or any Indian is bad. No, what I'm saying is you've got to understand that some of these parts of these countries are hundreds of years behind us, and they're hundreds of years behind us in their whole attitude, social interaction, the concept of the ownership of women, all these things. I mean, we only passed our own Married Woman's Property Act in the early 1880s, all right? Not that long ago. These people wouldn't even understand what the concept of a Married Woman's Property Act was. They just don't get it, and they don't want to integrate. They have no interest in integrating. And my friends in Oman, where I was at Defence College with, they are astonished that we let them in. They are Muslims. My friends in Oman and places are Muslims, but they're not the sort of characters who are turning up here. They say they can't come into the United Arab Emirates. They can't come into Oman. They can't come into these places unless they do a job of work and they're heavily tracked. They send their money home to their families and they're sent back again when they finish. Very tightly controlled. Muslim countries don't put up over there, what we put up with here. And we have Fabian judges, of course, who say, oh, well, he didn't understand that raping a 10-year-old girl was wrong. He didn't understand. Bullshit! You do that in some of these places, you get your balls cut off by the girl's father because he ruined her marriage opportunities. So this business, they don't understand this. They understand only too well. What they do understand is they won't be punished. They won't be disciplined in any way when they behave like this. And I saw a clip, you may have seen it, in a hotel. It must have been a nice hotel because they had a grand piano. They had a grand piano, which was trashed on camera. They systematically trashed a relatively new grand piano in the hotel. Lucky I didn't run the hotel. They'd have got a spanking, I can tell you. But this is the problem. This is the problem that we're dealing with. Now people say, why? Why is this happening? The question is, why is this happening? It is the whole point of globalists, the WEF, and Fabian judges and Fabian politicians, of which there are scores now, to destroy the infrastructure and the ethos and the history of this country. That is the point. So there's no point in Nigel Farage telling, oh, we believe the European Court of Human Rights and we need to do this, and we need to send them home, and we need to do this. It's all bullshit. They're here quite deliberately. Why on earth would we put them in four-star hotels? Why would they get preferential medical and dental treatment? Why would they get pocket money and four? And they're all young men of military age. All young men. There are no women and children there. Come on, everybody, wake up. Why do you think they're coming in? Why do you think the Navy can't turn them back? Why do you think the Special Boat Squadron can't go across and tear up their boats? Dear, oh dear, this isn't an accident. This isn't because the Home Office are incompetent. This is because it's part of a plan of action. There are now more Muslims in the country than Welshmen in the United Kingdom. It's not an accident, is it? I mean, if anybody believes that's an accident, they're really stupid. Or if they think the CIA didn't start the war in the Ukraine, they're really stupid.
Mm. So what do you think the plan is then? Just basically population replacement of Brits?
Well, it's no different to the old days of communism. Why did we have communist shop stewards in the 1960s and 70s going out of their way to destroy things like British Leyland, Red Robbo? All right? It was to destroy the infrastructure of the country so that once you've broken down the institutions, once you've broken down the principles of English law, once you've broken down the charities are all infiltrated, once you've broken down the concept of Magna Carta and all the rest of things, you leave the country bare, bereft of any self-respect in their history or their families or their legal systems or anything. Then you can impose your globalism on them. And it was the same way with communism. You can't put communism in until you've got rid of what's already there. And in the course in the Soviet Union, they wanted to get rid of the church. They wanted to get rid of the Orthodox, Russian Orthodox Church. And of course, the silly thing is, the more you try and squeeze somebody's religious beliefs away, the stronger they get. And the reason our churches are empty is because our bishops and archbishops are part of it. They're part of the game. I'm a professional guide at York Minster. I don't do much of it these days. York Minster, I'm a professional guide. Huge posters all over the deanery. Refugees welcome. And I spoke to the dean going back a couple of years. It's a huge house. You can imagine, can't you? It's stood there for hundreds of years. It has 42 bedrooms. I said, how many refugees have you got in there, Dean? None, but because of but me no buts. I said, but me no buts. How many have you got? And the answer is none. Of course, how many in Lambeth Palace? Eh? None. These people, look at the guy with the microphone that goes around talking to these people and say, you know, refugees, welcome. Would you take any? Come, I'm signing up. Would you take a refugee? No, I can't. I haven't got room. Oh, I've got rented accommodation. There's a wonderful reason people don't take them into the house. Even if you're unassessed, not if you've got a grand piano, they're going to trash the grand piano. I can't afford a grand piano. I've got a perfectly modest piano over there. I'd love a grand piano.
I completely agree. It's always this thing where I want this nice thing to be done, but I want someone else to do it. I couldn't possibly do it. There's some reason, but everyone else should do it. That seems to be a very typical thing with modern progressive lefty types, but I'm sure there's a name for it. let's move on from that scandal, because I know that time is short. There was another thing that this year, you probably heard about it. There's a professor called David Betts, a professor of war studies at I can't remember which college in London, and he was is predicting civil war in Britain. And he's done the rounds of the podcasts, interviews. Some people are very suspicious of him because of his establishment background. Others think he's broken, he's gone rogue, he's broken free of that, and he's speaking honestly. Have you heard of this, David Betts?
Yes, I have. I'm not very familiar with his work. But I have heard about it, and I have had some thoughts about it, if you will, which I think maybe shed a little bit of light onto it. First of all, you have to understand what a civil war is. And of course, most people don't really understand what a civil war is. Now, your Americans imagine they had a civil war in 1861, and they didn't. The North invaded the South. It was a war between the Northern states and the Southern states. Of course, we've had revisionist history for all sorts of things, reasons since then, but that's what it was. You had the Northerners fighting the Southerners. Now, a civil war is brother against brother, brother against father, mother against daughter, et cetera, et cetera. That's a civil war when it's built on a set of ideals that you don't agree with or you want to employ or, you know, something of that nature. Let's take the Spanish Civil War. You had communists, you had royalists, and you had fascists. Everybody wanted a different way of governing Spain, and they fought brother against brother. That's a civil war. It was the same in one of the English civil wars when the roundheads, if you were, they wanted parliamentary ascendancy. They wanted this. They wanted that. And of course, you had your royalists who wanted this and they wanted that. So, again, it was brother against brother. Now, for Britain to have a civil war would be really, really weird, because nobody takes a particularly strong enough idealistic position in order to go personally into a civil war because you believed in, you know, one form of government or another, or one kind of religion or another. So that's where I think David Betts is getting it wrong. However, where I do sympathize with him a little bit is nobody goes to war really on an empty stomach. But what you might find if you're in a town, and I think Epping is a very good example, the Bell Hotel at Epping, which is full of illegal immigrants, and if you have one of the little girls from your village assaulted by some monster who lives in there, it means that you're not going to want, you don't want to go to war with your brother or your sister or your cousins or your aunts or the next village. What you want to do is you want to tear that building down and kick them out. Now, that I can see happening. That I can see happening. And of course, it will be largely a working class result, because in the cities, it's always the working classes that get the shit end of the stick. Always, in every way, probably in every country. Your English middle class would never, I mean, they wouldn't actually, if you broke into the house, shot the dog and raped their wife, they'd just wring their hands. That's your modern English middle class. All right. And they nearly all work in the public sector. They're all useless, waste of space. But you're, and I would say this, I'm in the north of England, I can tell you, your ordinary working artisan, working class Yorkshireman give you a bloody good hiding. He'd certainly burn your hotel down. And of course, we've seen that happening in Belfast. They're tough buggers in Belfast, and they've had their troubles before. They're not putting up with it. And there'll come a time it'll be triggered off. It'll be one, the big march in London earlier this year with the Union Jacks and all the rest of it. That was peaceful. That was very peaceful. It doesn't take much to turn that from being peaceful to very angry. And there was a million there. I know there was a million there. I can tell you, there was a million there. Never mind the Daily Telegraph or the Guardian pretending it was 100,000. Bullshit. There was a million. Now, if they suddenly leave their families and their children behind and they forget the flags and they take a pointed stick or a sharpened stick or a shotgun, you're going to see trouble. And I think David Betts might be right if he's thinking that day may come sooner than we think. Sooner than we think.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to, it's a huge topic, but I know that time is short. So we'll move on to the issue of trial by jury. Now, this, I think, is a key thing this year for Britain. It's quite astonishing to, and I know that in other countries they don't have trial by jury, and I know that, but it's irrelevant. This is Britain, and this has been a mainstay of our cultural life, our cultural furniture, and civic life for centuries. What do you think is the background to that? Why do you think this is happening? They say it's to help clear the backlog of cases, so they want to expedite. I see you're sceptical about that.
Oh, it's ridiculous. If you just do the numbers, you just get a calculator and see How many cases are we behind? And how fast do we think things might move if we had we didn't have a trial by June? I mean, it's on the margin. It's on the margin. It's easy to Google up the numbers. It's on the margin. No, the point is what they want. If people who get arrested, and we've had more arrests in this country now for hurty words on social media than anywhere else in the world. This was the country of free speech. Now you'll be arrested. But of course, we're beginning to learn, or the poor little sods who've been arrested are beginning to learn something. If you plead not guilty and get in front of a jury, you will be out of their speed of light. You know, because no jury is going to convict somebody for saying Keir Starmer's a prat or whatever it happens to be. So consequently, they have to put in judges. Now, have a look, and you look at the background of these socialists, many of them are Fabians. So consequently, they want to change society. They want to bang up who anybody who is protesting with hurty words or all the rest of it. They are the bad people. They're not difficult to spot, because if you look at their CVs, they're very often quite honest about their membership of the Fabian Society when they're at university. I think they'll be a bit more circumspect now. I would also suggest, if you see a judge with an untrimmed beard, he's dodgy. He's dodgy. I would argue that's a golden rule. He will almost certainly be a Fabian. I'm not talking about James Robertson Justice, kind of beautifully trimmed beard and very nice too. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a fundamentally scruff bag who's got on the bench because he's a political appointee. And you know he's going to bang everybody up who said something nasty about illegal immigration or about the government, about anything else. Stands out a mile. And this is the problem that we've got. You need to get rid of trial by jury if you're going to do that. 12 Good Men and True, which goes back, and people, your academics will say, oh, yes, I know, but that was the barons and so on and so forth. But it's not. If you look a little bit deeper, you'll find that Magna Carta, the concept of Magna Carta, was an establishment of what was, broadly speaking, Anglo-Saxon common law. And then you can come back to 1608, you can come back to 1688, the Toleration Acts, come back to so on and so forth. As our law developed, and we had the highest standard of law, the principles of law in the world, which is why it's been adopted by so many. The United States adopted it. Much of the Indian subcontinent, much of Africa, although it tends to be a little bit abused in the African continent. But it's a very good system of law because it's very fair, common law and statute law. And if you are accused of something, you're entitled to trial by your peers to make that decision. You know, those 12 good men and true. And of course, I would say, never mind getting rid of trial by jury. I'd go back to the old principle. You have to be 21 years old and a property holder. I don't consider a lot of the people on juries today are my peers. And neither would you. And I would suspect neither would most of your listeners.
Definitely.
I want other householders. I'm a householder. I'm a businessman. I'm a taxpayer. I held the Queen's Commission. I want to see 12 faces who've got something in common with me. And that was why the system was so good. And then, of course, who's driving it through? By David Lammy. David Lammy, who you and I and most of your listeners would consider to be cretinous. Cretinous. I mean, who followed Henry VIII, Henry VII? I mean, come on. Really?
I know. I almost feel bad talking about David Lammy because it's like shooting fish in a barrel. The guy, he just shouldn't be where he is. And everyone knows that. And he's been artificially promoted and pushed all through his career. Everyone can see it. It's blatantly obvious. He's as thick as mince. And it's just embarrassing. But now he has obviously been put in place to do this assault on the English Constitution. And that's reprehensible. It's not the idiot who's been put in place, but the much more crafty people who put him in place.
Of course, it's racism at its height. If he was white, he would not be there.
No, absolutely not. Okay, I'll ask you one last question about Reform and Farage this year, Nigel Farage. I know you've had experience with Nigel Farage, and you've talked about him before on Millennial. What would you say about I mean, it looks like they're going to win the next election, whenever it is. Would you agree with that?
Well, 4 years is a very long time. There's some questions, and they're not they're not a particularly critique of Nigel Farage personally or intellectually, which really would be too easy. No, what I would suggest is, here's the problem. Reform is a limited company with majority shareholders, only two majority shareholders. This is your problem. And there is no recruitment discipline that, per se, as you and I might understand it. Goodness me, it was bad enough in the Conservative government, wasn't it? You had dyed-in-the-wool socialists with blue rosettes. We've just got a Reform mayor in the East Riding of Yorkshire who can't wait to spread more wind turbines over the beautiful Yorkshire wolds. How did he get through the net? And it's because it's all about, I don't know, there seems to be too many weird people involved and too much money changing hands. I believe we desperately need a new political party which will take us back, to our traditional ways, to the traditional ways of thinking, the principles of English law. There's only one man I know with intellectual depth to do that, and that's Ben Habib. Everybody else is pretty lightweight. I would argue perhaps that, which is the one of the, they chucked out, the guy who was
Rupert Lowe.
Rupert Lowe. He had some intellectual depth. So the only two people with enough intellectual depth to actually mould the Reform Party have been thrown out. So your viewers and people will make of it what you will. But of course, what people are saying on the street and in the ballot boxes is Labour are so bad that anybody must be better. But then we did think, if you go back a little bit, the Conservatives were so bad, how could anybody be worse? Boy, didn't we learn that lesson quickly.
Yeah. Quite amazing. Of course, you've talked about Nigel Farage before, and I think you used the word sociopath to describe him on Millennial. And what's interesting is the thing that happened earlier this year with Rupert Lowe. I think that was amazingly ruthless, what Farage did to Rupert Lowe, trying to get him criminal charges, humiliation, reputational damage, and even accusing him of having dementia and violence as well. So it was astonishing. It was like a complete, what would you say, full spectrum attack on Rupert Lowe's character and reputation. I was amazed at the. I thought it was actually quite clumsy because it was so comprehensive. You would choose one thing and push that, but Farage seemed determined to rubbish him in every possible way. I find that very concerning about the future, because if that's what Farage does with someone who is talented, then that shows he simply cannot tolerate people who could threaten his predominance in the organization. He has to destroy them. What would you say about that?
Well, you see, first of all, let me just clear one thing up. I believe all senior politicians should be sociopaths, for the simple reason most of us don't see the person on our own team as being the enemy, but that's politics for you. When I was in the army and I was a troop commander, for example, as I was, I wanted the very best corporals around me and the best sergeants to stop me making a goat of myself. I needed them. But if you look around your team, or whether it's rugby or football or cricket, and get rid of people because they might be looking better than you're looking at the moment, or might look cleverer than you or more articulate, as Rupert Lowe was, quite clearly, then you have this sort of problem. And so Rupert Lowe had to go. I would have been, if I'd been leader of Reform, said, thank goodness for that. I've got a really good guy here who I can make Home Secretary. So if anybody asks me, like Andrew Neil, who's going to be Home Secretary, I can say Rupert Lowe. Bang. Who's going to be this? I can say Ben Habib or something like that. And I can actually present to the electorate people with some proven skills who are articulate, knowledgeable. Not get rid of them because they might shine brighter than me. But here's another thing, just to finish off with this, is if you have somebody like that, who is a make of it, everybody makes of it what they will, in charge of MI5, MI6, and the police, this is very concerning, isn't it? It means that you can stack whatever you want when you're the prime minister. You can stack it however you want to stack it. And had, I think, Nigel been prime minister, Rupert Lowe would now be in prison. And I think that's pretty unhealthy. But I could easily be wrong. There's always a first time.
Yeah, there is. It's this. I agree with you. I think an acid test for any leader is, can he bear to promote people who might actually be better than him? In other words, can he bring people on board who might outshine him, who are on his level or even above it? Because obviously it's an ego thing, but also their personal ego. People want to be, the people who do well tend to have an ego drive to do well. So they want to be prominent. And that conflicts with the actual success of the project. For this reason, because they won't be able to promote people who could actually help the project to succeed. But if you don't do that, and if you do what Nigel Farage has done, then you end up with the position, well, first of all, you have dumplings around you who will give you bad advice, and then you'll, in order to hold on to them, you'll have to follow their bad advice and do stupid things. But also, it means that you end up with a team that is very unimpressive, or no team at all. And that actually seems to be the situation with Reform. There's Nigel Farage, and then there's Zia Yusuf, and no one else. There is no team. It's just a one-man show. So that's a huge problem. And we'll see if Nigel Farage is able to grow out of this tendency over the next few years and actually assemble a competent team.
You see, the thing is, that's Reform. Brexit was the same. UKIP was the same. You know, sooner or later, you have to look at a pattern, don't you? You can't say it's a one-off, or my goodness me, something's a mistake. It is a consistent situation with every political party that he has led. And I don't think you can go on glossing it over. And here's the thing, you said that everybody thinks Reform is going to win the election. I would suggest that it's not a foregone conclusion, because what people say and what people do in by-elections and local elections, and they say if they're interviewed, the man on the Clapham omnibus, when it gets to we've got to have a government, we've got to have somebody who can actually put a cabinet together, keep a cabinet together, and run some kind of team. And although the Conservative Party are at an all-time low because of their own stupidity and fake conservatism, if they can brush that away, and it looks at the moment like they probably can't, but if they can, and if you look at some of Kemi Badenoch's cross-examinations of the Prime Minister on the front bench, she's getting better by the week. She's getting more traction by the week. And when push comes to shove in 3 or 4 years' time, and people are really looking for a serious government, I think they might start to trickle back. If she can have a shadow cabinet, which is actually talking some sense, and get rid of all those people that found their way into the Conservative Party who weren't Conservatives. If she can do that, she could make a comeback.
All right. Now that would be a surprise turn of events, but I wouldn't be surprised. As you say, the electorate are, when it comes to it, they are in Britain. They are very wary of new options. That's been the problem all along. Okay, there are three super chats. Soaker City. Mr. Bloom, do you have any thoughts on the undead British Empire remaining a powerful geopolitical force? Britain has legacy institutions that only a handful of nations do. My own grandfather was supposed to be in the World War II RAF, but had hay fever, thank God. I think Jerry would have pasted him. So the undead British Empire, do you think that there is still a lingering international influence of Britain abroad because of the institutions that we set up during the Empire?
Yes, I do. There could quite easily be. And of course, it's called not the undead British Empire. It's called the Commonwealth. And if there was an effective leader of the Commonwealth, we could bind together those principles, perhaps maybe democracy, principles of English law, so on and so forth. And everybody's got a different background, different culture, Africa, the Indian subcontinent. I've been to all these places. I have been to all these places. You could actually formulate something of that sort. We stabbed them all in the back when we joined the European Union. We walked away from them, which was a classic mistake. And now, of course, they're forming BRICS. They're going to BRICS, so on and so forth. But yes, there is the possibility with the right leader. But sadly, that's not King Charles III, who is hopeless.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We don't even need to go into that. Dardy said, I saw the Germans and some of the Scandinavian countries are putting themselves into massive debt to rearm to fight Russia. Pretty insane when people can't afford to heat their homes or buy their groceries. Yeah, we already talked about that, but if there's anything that you'd want to say about the situation in Germany and Scandinavia?
Well, yes, I think it's all saber-rattling. It's ridiculous. Apart from the fact, what weapons are they going to buy? We don't have the Reshniks. We do not have the kind of kit that the integrated systems like drones and so on and so forth, and far more advanced, certainly, fighter planes than us. The F-35A is now being shown to be a bit of a dog's breakfast as well. Yeah, they can spend as much money as they like pouring money into the industrial military complex. But did you see the demonstrations against the potential problems of conscription in Germany last week? There was hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating against it. It's not going to happen. It can't happen. And it's not about weaponry. And they can't manufacture it. I mean, the artillery shells, armored personnel carriers, all these things need production. We don't have any production in this country. We don't have any production in Europe. Germany is going down the tubes. Volkswagen is virtually packed up because of net zero. Don't get me started on net zero. The number of people that are going to lose their jobs, already have lost their jobs, who can't heat their homes because of this criminally insane hoax that people have bought into, or have they bought into, or is it WEF all over again? I mean, the idea that 0.03% carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is going to boil the planet is so fundamentally ridiculous, I don't know where it came from. Again, it can only be WEF. And I tell you who is never allowed on legacy media, Professor Ian Plimer and others, who are internationally renowned climate scientists who actually call the thing out for the bullshit that it is, are not allowed on your TV screens. So people believe it. People believe all this nonsense, even if they're subliminally. But when they can't heat the home, when they start freezing and grandma dies because she can't afford to turn the thing up, maybe they might wakey, 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 but I don't know. I despair. The problem is that all the levers of power in Britain are by the middle class, certainly the English middle class, who as a genre are the most stupid people on the face of this planet.
Yeah. One more question. Do you believe either of Trump's major peace plan initiatives, that being Israel-Palestine or Russia-Ukraine, have any hope of actually achieving peace in these terrible conflicts? Thanks and have a Merry Christmas. So the Trump's plans for Israel-Palestine and Russia, we've already talked about Russia-Ukraine, but do you think there's any chance of these succeeding?
I have a Jack Russell Terrier bitch who knows more about international geo-military politics than Donald Trump. I'd sooner let my dog put together a peace plan. And the answer to that is simply, of course not. Of course not. They're ridiculous. 28 terms. Read the 28 terms for the Ukraine peace plan. Utterly ludicrous. And of course, while Israel controls the hill, nothing's going to come forward. I mean, you've only got to look at the situation. What congressman or senator isn't bought body and soul by the Israelis? So no, how can there be a peace plan when the whole foreign policy is run by Tel Aviv? Ludicrous.
All right. We've gone for half an hour longer than we arranged to, so I think we should probably end it now. This has been another barnstorming appearance on Millennial, so thank you very much, Godfrey, for agreeing to do this. People always look forward to you every year, so I'm very glad when we get it confirmed.
Thank you very much.
There aren't any more... Yeah. All right. So we'll end it there. I'll be back in 2 hours with Mark Houghton. We'll see what happens with the distributist. Who knows? In the meantime, Godfrey Bloom, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.